Hello, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Glow West podcast, where we chat about sex, sexuality, and the body. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and I'm delighted to be a part of the Tortoise Shack Network, where you can find tons of content on politics, culture, society, and of course, sex. If you like what we do, please do consider supporting us at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. So today in the podcast, we're taking a little bit of a different approach. We often talk about autonomy and choice and consent on the podcast, and that's generally in relation to sex and sexuality and issues such as, you know, consent to sex. But consent to a wider range of issues around your body is a conversation that we really do need to have. And how does bodily autonomy fit into those conversations? So I'm very, very, very honoured today to be joined by someone who is an active campaigner in this area, and that is Vicky Phelan. So Vicky was born in Kilkenny in Ireland, and she's always really demonstrated resilience and determination, and some would say quite a level of stubbornness. She's the first in her family to go to college. She survived a serious car accident when quite young. She relearned how to live. She went on to complete her studies and work as a teacher and translator. However, in 2013, her life changed. 2 years earlier, Vicky had participated in the National Cervical Screening Programme. Her results were wrongly reported as normal, a fact that was withheld from her, and just 2 years later, she developed cervical cancer. Faced with a personal tragedy of this magnitude, it would have been understandable for Vicky to withdraw and focus on her own needs. Instead, she realised what had happened to her was likely to have happened to others, she took the decision to make public her experience and expose the screening programme and the healthcare system to much needed examination. Something which is absolutely ongoing to this very present day. Vicky, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me today. I hope you're keeping well today.
Thanks very much, Caroline. It's been long overdue. We've been planning this for quite a while. So
the joys of COVID.
The joys of COVID, but we're here today, thank God.
We're here. We'll make up for last time, don't worry. Yeah. So you were diagnosed back in 2013. I think we've lost all sense of time at the moment with COVID, but that's 7 years ago. And you've spent those 7 years on an utterly life-changing journey, not for yourself necessarily as such, but for other people as well. Your focus has been on really supporting other people as well, rather than just focusing on your own journey. And I was really struck when reading your autobiography that you learned how to swim, and it wasn't just necessarily for the fun of swimming, but it was to learn how to save a life. And now you're saving other lives. So, but how does a lifeguard look after themselves?
Wow, God, I never thought of it that way. I think, I suppose, when I start doing things, I always have to have a big goal in mind. I'm not one of these people. I started running, and most people would start running and want to do a 10K. I decided I'd do a marathon. You know, I think I'm just one of those people that has to have a big goal at the end of it to keep me motivated, I think, more than anything else. How do I look after myself? Sometimes very poorly, I suppose, you know, but generally I'm quite good. I've become, you know, I think you have to be a bit selfish, and some people wouldn't call it selfish. And I suppose that's the danger, isn't it? That you'd think, I can't spend all this time on my own. I should be doing this. I should be doing that.
But self-care isn't selfish.
No, absolutely not. And it's something I've actually become better at doing myself. And it's something I really try and instill in my daughter, because I think my mother certainly wouldn't have instilled it in me, because she came from that generation where, you know, you can't be sitting down doing nothing. You have to, you know, my mother finds it very hard to sit down and read a book, you know, unless there's nobody around. Otherwise, she has to be fussing over everybody. So I think it's something that you're just brought up with, you know. So, yeah, no, I suppose for me, I find the sea. The sea is my place where I go to kind of be on my own. And sometimes I go there to work off whatever's going on in my head. Or sometimes I just go there, you know, not to think at all, just to listen to the sea. And that has always been, for me, the water. You know, from a very early age, we lived right beside the river when I was small. And, you know, at the age of three, I disappeared. I'm sure you saw that in my book.
And that was where my... Your poor parents.
Yeah, my poor parents. From a very early age, I was causing them a lot of problems. But, you know, I decided I was going down to the river, and me and the dog went off. And, you know, so the river or the sea, you know, water in general just does it for me. So, you know, and I'm very lucky, I suppose, that I live in Limerick right beside UL, which has a fabulous walk all along the River Shannon. And, you know, I bought a holiday home in Doonbeg right beside the beach, my favourite beach. So, you know, I get to see the sea quite a bit, which is, a huge luxury.
Yeah, absolutely. And but I think that fascination with water is an interesting thing because I have that a little bit as well. If I get really stressed, I like to go immerse myself in water and go into the pool because it's you're kind of creating your own little world. And you've essentially like that's a metaphor for you and creating your own new world, not just for yourself, but for other women in Ireland. Like you've changed realities for a lot of women trying to access healthcare in Ireland and people with cervixes. So there's some kind of parallels between you starting that at 3 years old and you're at this stage now in 2020 and changing that kind of world. So maybe it was, do you think it's a genetic thing? Do you think it's how you were raised? Do you think it's your
Yeah, I don't know.
environment?
I often get asked that, and I don't know. I mean, I look at my parents are not, overly confident people, or never really challenged the status quo. So I kind of don't know where this came from. It probably is genetic. But the only thing I suppose I would say about my parents is that, they were very young when they got married. Mom and dad were only 18 and 19 when they got married, very, very young. My mother was extremely bright. She had done her leaving cert, which,
So
a lot of
rare at
people
that time.
done back then. Yeah, and she was. Wanted to be a nurse, and I think she'd have made a fantastic nurse. She's such a caring person. But of course, she knew if she wanted to go nursing, she'd have to go to England, and she wasn't willing to leave my dad. So they got married, and she gave up on her dream. But I think she'd always instilled in me that thing, from a very young age, follow your dreams, do what you want to do. And she kind of said it quite a lot. So, I was nearly 30 by the time I got married. So, I've always been kind of very good at kind of following my own goals and following my own dreams, because my mother and father would have encouraged me, and they were always very proud of what I did, and that makes a huge difference, I think, when you're encouraged as a child.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm always fascinated by the concept of resilience and how people, some people that might be in your situation might kind of just roll over and accept it. And that's not saying out of choice, they mightn't have that skills or that level of resilience, but you do. And you've had that through your life. You see in your autobiography, like surviving that pretty horrific car accident when you're really quite young and, annoying all the doctors who are like, just, shut up. We know your body better than you do. And I believe they described you essentially as having an attitude problem, which speaks volumes, I suppose, on the ownership of the body and how doctors interpret that to be. That they're in control of your body more. So you started that, I think, were you 19 when that was going on?
Yeah, I was almost 19. I was 18. Yeah, 18 when it happened, and by the time I came out of hospital, I was 19. So, I was 3.5 months in hospital in total at that time. And yeah, that was the first thing I suppose that happened to me where I realized life isn't fair, And it's a hard thing to realize at such a young age. I think, we all, most people get to their, maybe mid-30s, and when maybe they have a miscarriage or, a relationship breakdown or, something happens along the way, where life problems kind of happen later on. It happened to me at a much earlier stage, and I became very bitter. I mean, yes, I have, a huge amount of resilience now, but I had to go through all of those things and learn coping mechanisms, and I haven't always done it well. And that's what I always like to say to people. I hope people, I really don't like people to think that I'm this superwoman. I'm not, I mean, my mother, I put my mother through hell, to be honest, after my car accident. I was so bitter and so angry and lashing out. And, I had to give up on my dream of going back to college. I mean, I tried it on crutches after coming out of hospital, maybe 3 weeks. And I mean, the doctors had told me I needed to take a year out of college, but sure, I'm so stubborn I wouldn't listen. And my parents, in fairness, knowing me as well as they do, they didn't try and convince me because they knew I had to do it myself. So I went off and realized after 2 weeks, could not do this. I was absolutely exhausted trying to hobble around on crutches, and just I just felt I wasn't ready emotionally. No way was I ready for it. So I took the year out, but of course that meant I had to stay at home for a while and do my rehabilitation. And that's when I started swimming once I came off the crutches. But then I decided I couldn't stay at home any longer because either I'd have killed my mother or she'd have killed me. So I went off to Spain. I mean, I'm just one of those people. I just thought, no, I was a weighing it all up in my head, and I thought, well, all my friends are going to come back now to college. Having spent the 9 months in Spain, I won't have gone to Spain at all. I'm going to be at a disadvantage. So feck that, I'm going to Spain. So off I went. You know, I rang one of my friends in Spain who was on Erasmus and asked her to put up a few notices because I had done au pairing before in France and got a job, and just told my parents, you know, that I'm heading off to Spain. My poor mother was in floods of tears,
I
but
can
she looked
imagine.
well used to me, you know.
Well, and that same, I suppose, stubbornness is, you know, can be used by some people as a negative thing. And I don't view that in negative terms at all. Like, I think it's a healthy characteristic to have, but it's also, you know, a stubbornness maybe to not stay in that bitter state. So you allowed yourself to, well, you maybe didn't have a choice of being bitter and angry, and justifiably so, of course, that, you know, as a young person you had all those experiences. But then you being you and being stubborn and going, I'm not staying in this state, I'm actually gonna, you know, keep going and keep pushing ahead. So that stubbornness is definitely, I wish, something that we all had, maybe, to keep going.
I often say that to parents. I said, if you have a stubborn child, don't be trying to change them. It's a good thing to have, especially later in life, when things, stubbornness gets you everywhere. It really does.
And especially a girl as well. I think a lot of girls are socialized into being nice and to being quiet and maybe more submissive style. And I think that's partly why we have this issue around women's health, that women are discouraged from speaking up about what's actually going on in their bodies, or if they're fobbed off by a doctor, they're kind of going, okay, you know, I'll accept that and leave it at that. So how do women find that courage to speak up and go, actually, there is something wrong going on here? And, you know, in your case, you know, you fought for other women, but, you know, to change that narrative around how we do smear tests in Ireland, you know, how those results are analysed. But how do we start as people finding that courage to go, hang on, like, I need to actually fight for myself here?
A lot of people contact me with this very same issue, a lot of women and girls. And, you know, when I've given talks around the country, people come up to me and, you know, I'm delighted when people say this. Usually I had this group of young girls who came up to me. They were just training to be psychologists, and they were all in their, you know, early 20s, and there's about five of them. And they said, because I'm, you know, as open and blunt as I am about everything, and I was talking about sex and vaginas and everything in this talk, because I will, you know, because I think these are things we need to talk about.
Absolutely.
Not taboo subjects, you know, I mean, everybody has a vagina and it's not just for sex, you know what I mean? So they came up to me and they said, you know, wow, you know, this is great to be able to hear you today, because, you know, it can give us courage and confidence to go in and, you know, talk about things with clients if they come in. Like, I was asking the psychologist kind of point in particular, because a lot of people go for counselling after they have cancer because it's so traumatic. The just getting your head around having cancer, the loss that you're going to experience, particularly if it's a gynae cancer, you know, you're not going to be able to have children again, you're going to have problems having sex again, so there's loads of issues. And I was kind of trying to say to the psychologist, you know, you need to be aware that there are issues that you may not be aware of. You know, it's not just about the cancer, it's about the side effects that women are living with, like incontinence and, you know, painful sex or not being able to have sex at all. And a lot of women will not openly talk about these things, so they'll have to try and delve and bring that out of them. So that's, you know, so they're the type of things for professionals. But then for general women, I would get normal women contacting me, you know, on a daily basis, still to this day, you know, asking me, you know, I think I have symptoms, you know, and I'm afraid to talk to my doctor. And the first question I ask them is, well, what kind of relationship do you have with your GP? Because it's very important. And, you know, if they say to me, well, you know, he's fobbed me off before, or she's fobbed me off before, and I'd say, well, you change your doctor. You know, and it's as simple as that. If you're not comfortable with your GP, you actually need to go and get another one. Or, you know, sometimes I know it's difficult that people can't move within a practice or out of a practice, but that you can find another GP within the practice. So try and get another GP that's on a different day. You know, there's ways and means around this. But for me, the key thing is to be comfortable with the doctor that you're talking to. And if you're not, then you either move or get a second opinion. But another thing I say to women is, apart from kind of going, you know, if they have issues, why don't you talk to your friends about these things? And that's one thing that women, you know, we talk about everything else. And we talk about when we're having problems in our marriages or, you know, sex lives. We won't talk about, God, I'm having a bit of bleeding here in between my periods, or I bled after sex. You know, these are things that we need to actually normalize. Because if one person says it, well, then it'll become a bit more normal. And other women would say, well, that's not normal. You know, maybe you should go to your doctor. So I think, you know, talking to our friends about these things, making these conversations more open, and then, you know, having a trusting relationship with your GP.
Do you think that having more comprehensive sex education would help in that aspect? Because I think we don't know enough about our bodies sometimes, and part of that is the fault of sex education and a society where it's like we just say, oh, that's your private parts, and we don't know even the correct names, or what the cycles of our periods are, all those kind of things. So do you think that would help and really start that conversation at a younger age, maybe, about what our bodies are actually like?
Yeah, absolutely. I would totally agree with that. I'm definitely one of those parents who would welcome far more sex education. I suppose I'm very lucky that even as a child myself, because my parents were so young, when they had me, that mum and dad were always very open with us and we were able to ask them anything. Now, mum used to tell me, by the time my sister came along, I'm the oldest, she's the youngest, it was sex education was getting a little bit better at that stage. She'd be dreading my sister coming in the door with all the questions, but she'd always answer them. She might feel a little bit embarrassed and whatever, but my parents were always very good and very open about talking about sex and anything like that. So I suppose, I've definitely tried to do that with my children. So nothing is taboo in our house either. So I will talk about anything with my daughter. She's 15 now, and like she has no issue with talking to her dad about her periods. She took a day off last week because she had cramps, and I wasn't here because I was in Dublin. And she just said it to her dad that morning. Yeah, dad, I've got my period. They're really bad in the first day. Can I stay at home? And I know a lot of girls who wouldn't be able to say that to their dads. So I think it's great. I think it also has to happen at home too. And I think we need to be a bit better about. And I think we are in general, but there are still some people who don't want to see this happening in school or think children are too young to be learning this. No, they're not. And then they need to be, I mean, you're the expert in this, Caroline, but I would say they need to be starting this at 9 or 10. Because they're becoming more sexualized anyway, with Instagram and everything that's been thrown at them.
And the fact that you can have your period now at 9 and 10,
Yeah,
it
my
is
daughter was
quite a
10.
young age. She's
Yeah,
10.
I know, 10.
Yeah, like that's very young, and for a lot of people, like a period is extremely traumatic to have, especially if you have no idea what's about to happen and you have all this blood, coming out of you. And that's actually one of the symptoms of cervical cancer. So it's that abnormal vaginal bleeding, so bleeding between periods or after sex, or not as relevant to younger people, after the menopause. But that's something that can often be dismissed as, oh, that's a side effect of contraception. Or, keep an eye on it or something like that. And I think that dismissal can be quite prevalent. Or even if you Googled it, people would say, oh, it's a side effect of whatever, as opposed to check for cervical cancer. So if you don't know what normal bleeding is for your body, how do you know what abnormal bleeding is?
Yeah, so that's why when I talk about the bleeding, I talk about colours, because you have to talk about the colours, because if you don't, some girls don't really understand. Like, normal menstrual blood is dark, dark red, and when it dries, it's almost black, it's dark. This abnormal bleeding with cervical cancer is like pinkish red, and often it's more blood, especially if you bleed after sex, it's like bright red, because what's happening is the bright red that you're bleeding after sex is your tumour shedding. So it's bright red vascular blood. That's
Okay.
the difference.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
it's not the same as like you bleed in between your periods and it's a dark red, but that's more like, shedding of your womb. It's obviously, it could be endometriosis. There's other explanations for it or a cyst. But for cervical cancer, the bleeding in between your periods is a different color altogether. It's like pinkish red, and it can be kind of stringy, So I
Yeah,
think it's
different
very
texture as
important
well.
to talk about that, because that's what happened to me, and I have no issue with talking about it, because if it saves another woman from getting this disease, it's worth it.
Absolutely. And even one of the other symptoms is pain or discomfort during sex. And I recently had Lisa from the Vaginismus Network on, and she talked about how she had 8 years of a journey of painful attempts at sex, and then before she realized, oh, actually this is vaginismus, or vaginismus, sorry. But again, it's that kind of shame. She didn't think that that was, something to talk to her doctor about. She didn't have the words. She was so embarrassed because sex is just this big thing that we all are meant to be having, and it's meant to be great all the time. And problems like, or we might actually associate a bit of pain with sex, like to be a normal thing as well. But it's not necessarily that case. So that shame and stigma really does impact people recognizing those symptoms of cervical cancer as well.
Yeah, it does. And also, when I look back on it now in hindsight, I actually remember having experienced pain at times during sex before I realized I had cancer. And I ignored it, Caroline, because again, you know, you kind of think, oh, well, maybe, you know, it's just too rough, or, you know, we're going at it too hard, whatever. You don't think that this is something that might not be normal. And I kind of ignored it. And, you know, if I hadn't ignored it and if I'd known more, you know, and these are the things that I think are important to point these things out. I know now the pain was because I had a bloody 4 centimeter tumor developing, you know, and that's what was causing the pain. But it didn't bleed until, you know, this one time that it did. But at that stage, I'd had maybe 2 or 3 months of kind of bleeding in between periods that led up to this. But, you know, my thing is, if I had known all of those symptoms before and had gone a little bit sooner, you know, things could be different. That's why I talk so openly about these things.
Yeah. And then the fact that, you know, that pain is normalized, like you said, sometimes of just we'll just dismiss it. And if it's not once off, is it a particular type of pain when people need to keep an eye out for, or does it vary from person to person?
I think it varies from person to person, just from talking to other women. But I know in my case, it just felt like, you know, when it was kind of like very hard penetration, that I felt the pain kind of almost, it felt almost like it was up your back passage, even though it wasn't. I wasn't having anal sex, obviously. Yeah. But it felt like that kind of a pain, that it was hitting the back wall. You know, it was quite painful, you know.
Okay, so definitely that's something to keep an eye on. And that discomfort, even, I know you say the word back passage there, and you know, like we kind of shy away sometimes from talking, even like mentioning the word vulva, a lot of people don't even know what it is, let alone able to say it, or vagina, or cervix is a little bit, you know, more neutral, I suppose, for some people. Vagina has the connotations of sex to it a little bit more. But do you think that, you know, in you telling your story in the media, it might encourage people to be a little bit more comfortable with those terms and see them as they're just body parts. They're not necessarily these loaded words that bring with them all sorts of connotations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I remember the first few times I spoke about this, and a lot of the time, as you know, you're talking to men, you know, when I was giving interviews, or I did a couple of at the Public Accounts Committee, you know, it's nearly all men, but, you know, I don't care. I'm at the point where, you know, if this helps other women, that's why I'm doing it. So, you know, and at the end of the day, like you said, you know, my vagina is far more than sex. It has been about far more than sex in my life. You know, I've done far more with my vagina than sex in my 46 years. And actually in the last few years, it's all been medical. You know what I mean? So you have children, you know, it's just a body part like any other. And I suppose, you know, in the beginning, I did find it a bit kind of, you know, strange talking about it. But then I just got comfortable with it. And I just thought, no, do you know, and I could see the impact that it was having on other women, and women were contacting me. And that kind of pushed me further, you know, to be a bit more open, because I thought, once you open that box, that's it. You can't go back in, you know.
Absolutely.
There's great freedom in it. You know, there's great freedom in it, because there is a certain amount of shame involved in I certainly felt that anyway, when I got diagnosed with cervical cancer first. I remember telling, you know, an older woman, you know, that I had cervical cancer, and, you know, straight away, you know, she just changed the subject, and, you know, it was shameful, you know, because there is an association. I don't think it's not as much anymore, but there's certainly, you know, and it was still there with the Scally report, you know, with some of the comments that came out with some of the consultants, that, you know, a woman who gets cervical cancer has to have been promiscuous, you know.
Which is, boils my blood completely.
You know, exactly. So they don't equate it to men with prostate cancer, you know, so, yeah.
Or even if it was arm cancer or lung cancer, you know, we're not saying like, oh, well, how did your sex life, how many penises were inside the, you know, the vagina, and when's the cutoff point for good cancer or bad cancer?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's bizarre. So you're obviously extremely experienced at this point of sharing your story to such a variety of audiences, from, you know, proper authorities, to people in the media, to people, I'm sure, everywhere. I'm sure you probably don't get mince peace if you're going out even to the supermarket or whatever. Do you think that people either they fall into the category of they ask too much, they ask personal details, or do they have a fear of asking the questions and try and pretend like it's not happening?
Asking me, is it?
Yeah.
No, I think generally when people are asking me questions, and it's an awful way to put this, but I feel like they feel like they can only ask me, you know, and it's a huge burden that I feel at times, you know. That it's a terror. It's terrible that these people feel that they can't ask a professional, that they feel they can only trust me. And that sometimes kind of weighs very heavily on me. So there are times, so during the week, I don't check my new messages every day. I can't because I'm inundated. And a lot of those messages, when I filter through them, are, you know, terrible stories of people, you know, my wife is, you know, dying with stage four, you know, whatever type of cancer, and we're trying to get in a clinical trial, you know, but we're not getting any help. You know, they're terrible stories that really, you know, it break your heart, you know, and you're trying to help these people. But, you know, it's usually those type of questions I get asked. It's usually when people are at the end of the line and you know, they don't have anywhere else to go. Or women contacting me about, you know, smear test or, you know, abnormal bleeding, things like that. That's generally what I get asked about. And, you know, I have to be very careful too, Caroline, because I'm not a professional. You know, I'm just, you know, I'm not a medical professional. I have the experience of having cervical cancer. And I have to say that to people because, you know, you don't want to be kind of saying, you know, this is not advice. This is not medical advice. This is just, you know, my experience of it. And from what you're telling me, I think you should do X, Y, or Z. But I'm not a medical professional. So it's a kind of a...
It's a hard line to...
Every time I feel like I would never ignore somebody like that because I often feel like I'm their last resort. And isn't that terrible to think that, you know?
And that's a lot of extra work for you to do and emotional work because if you're hearing all the stories of trauma all the time and people have been desperate because that's, of course, you are in that situation and you're trying whatever you can and... That must be difficult to kind of find that balance between I want to give you objective advice, but also I sympathize with you as a human that's going through such a traumatic time.
It is. And I had to pull back from it an awful lot because I was trying to reply to them all and I couldn't. I'm one person, you know, at the end of the day. So I just do it one or two days a week now because that's as much as I can do, because it is quite emotionally draining, you know, because I mean, I'm still in treatment myself and, you know, I have to mind myself too.
Yeah. I feel like so much of your work is helping other people, you know, like you're learning to swim so you can help others and you waived your right to anonymity to, you know, in order to help other women. And you've spent your time dragging the HSE and the government through court and rightly so and all that kind of thing. But where do you get to focus on your own journey in that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Very, very little, actually. You know, I mean, what I normally do is, like today now, for example, I stayed in bed this morning because I didn't have to get up. So I would, you know, always stay in bed two or three mornings a week because I get really tired. You know, last week knocked me for six with the launch of the Dying with Dignity bill because I had to go to Dublin and I was busy at loads of interviews, loads of podcasts. And something else happened last week. I can't remember, but like it was one of those weeks where just everything happened. And literally I was, by the time the weekend came around, I was absolutely floored. So it takes me a while to come back, you know? But I allow myself those days, you know, where I don't have to get dressed and I'll just sit at home in my pajamas. But I'm not always good at that, you know, and sometimes I'm not very good at saying no either. You know, I mean, every time I check my phone, there's a request for an interview or, you know, podcast or a talk or you know, and I've become better at saying no. I have to say I have become better, but I'm, you know, I will always look at it and go, but that's for a really good cause, or you know
you start justifying
it, exactly. So
but do you think that there's a parallel there between the boundaries and the medicalization, I suppose, of your body and how people think that you're very accessible then in the media and that they can reach out to you on that constant basis to request your time and to share your story. And your story is one of trauma. So is there a recognition of the possibility of, you know, that people asking you, here, tell us the details of this horrific event is re-traumatizing?
Because sometimes, you know, I do find that sometimes if I have to do an interview, if something has happened, you know, or if I've gotten bad news, like when Ruth died, that really, you know, I didn't do any interviews for a couple of days because I was so upset, you know, and traumatized. And this is something that's going to come to me, you know, in the not too distant future. So it's very hard for me. And I often think people don't see that, you know, and that's why I got so angry that week. And, you know, I had a bit of a meltdown, I suppose, and had a pop at the a whole lot of them all really about, you know, the way, you know, these aide de camps turn up at funerals. And, you know, me being me, I just thought, you know what, I don't want any of that. And I don't want any of that. And I suppose I thought I may as well do it now while I'm alive and tell them all I do not want all of this. So when the time comes that it won't happen, please God, or I'll come back and help them. But, you know, I do find that sometimes, you know, like I had a number of calls on the day of Ruth's death from journalists. And I just thought, you know, this is, I didn't answer them, needless to say. But I just thought, no, you know what, this is not appropriate, you know.
That's kind of not seeing you as a human, that's seeing you as Vicky Phelan, the campaigner. Who's always accessible.
I can't compartmentalise myself like that, you know, not when something like that happens, not when it's a friend, you know, and you're trying to get your head around it yourself. So you know, in fairness, most of the time, the media have been very good, but there are times when you kind of go, really, you know, but there are times when I'll bite back and I'd say, this is not appropriate, you know, and they know it. I mean, you know, I don't kind of shy away from that either.
No, I can see that. So, but do you see a future where women can, you know, we can expose injustice against women, because there's probably going to be something else that, you know, we're going to discover. Like, you know, we've had cases of, you know, the Magdalene Laundries, and women have had to come forward and fight for justice. We've had, you know, the cancer scandals where women have had to come forward and fight for justice. And again, it's outing yourself. It's having to share your story over and over again. And we see that a little bit with racism at the moment, that people have to go on and say, here's the exact words that I was called. And you still get people who argue back about that. But do you see a point where women... we might get to where women don't have to publicly tell and retell their trauma in order to achieve that exposure of the injustices that are there without us having to be further re-traumatized by the exposure of that process?
Not in my lifetime, I don't, anyway. No, I don't think so. That's awful, isn't it, to say, but no, I don't. I mean, even in the 2.5 years since the cervical check scandal, you know, very little has changed, really. You know, we've probably had more than most other scandals. You know, we were very lucky that we had Gabriel Scally appointed to do an independent inquiry. And, you know, not only did he produce a report, he produced a report with recommendations. And in fairness to the HSE, you know, a lot of those recommendations have been put in place. But of course, you know, the important ones like mandatory open disclosure are still outstanding. So, you know, a lot of the ones that really involve best interests, you know, are outstanding. And that's always been the way in this country, unfortunately. So, you know, a lot of change in this country happens on an incremental scale, and it's really slow. But look, I've worked in the public sector all my life, so I don't think they kind of banked on that I'm used to the slow state of progress. So I'll keep going at it for as long as I'm here anyway, you know. I won't get put off too easily.
And I don't think anyone would be surprised that you would still be going. But do you think COVID has impacted that then as well? You know, the screening figures are really quite shocking. You know, in 2019, you know, over 200,000 people getting screened for cervical check, but it's only 39,000 so far for the first 6 months of this year. And breast cancer is quite low. And I think the bowel check is quite low as well. But how do you think COVID, like, are we learning any lessons from COVID and how cervical check was cancelled or will postponed for a lot of COVID?
I mean, this is it's a balance, isn't it? And I think one of the things that happened over COVID was that, you know, when the cervical check started up again in July, they issued, you know, a number of thousands of screening requests, but, you know, very few of them came forward. So, I mean, it's not just that the system isn't seeing as many people. People are not coming forward. So women are not coming in for their appointments because they're worried about getting COVID. So there's a kind of a, you know, it's like a vicious circle at the moment. And, like, to be honest, with cervical screening, I think would be far safer than breast screening. I had a mammogram a couple of months ago before COVID. And I had never had one before because I, you know, I'm not of the age, but I had, you know, a suspicious lump. So I had never realized how close they get. Like, they literally, you know, move your boob onto the tray. So they're literally, you know, you're breathing on top
close
of each
other. Personal.
So
yeah.
Until I had one, I didn't realize how, like, you know, there. So I can understand with the breast screening why that was delayed, because you are really, you know, in each other's spaces. Whereas with cervical screening, you know, I mean, if you put a screen from the woman's kind of belly button up, you know, there's quite a distance there. And I kind of argued that, and I said, well, why can't we continue? You know, because, you know, there is a distance there, and it's not as, but then they were saying they weren't sure whether COVID was transmitted through vaginal.
Oh, the fluids.
There was a whole host of other issues then as well. And also they didn't have the staff because staff were redeployed to other areas. So, you know, it's a whole host of issues in this country. But look, I suppose in fairness, they were still seeing symptomatic women. So anyone with symptoms was being seen. It's just the regular kind of 3 yearly intervals. But the problem is anyone who was due a smear this year, you know, they're going to be past, you know, kind of, so there's going to be a backlog because anyone who was due a screen next year, they're going to be competing with people for this year first. Do you know what I mean? So there's all of those issues. So I suppose the thing that we were trying to impress upon the National Screening Service was that, you know, the message is the communication needs to get out there that women need to be looking out for symptoms, because if there's going to be a backlog, symptomatic women need to be seen urgently if that's the case, you know.
And that's where that control over your body and knowing what's normal for your body and not is an important thing. Like you said about the pain and the knowing what abnormal bleeding actually looks like in that aspect. So, yeah. You've kind of moved on to a bit of, it's obviously connected, but a different project, I suppose, and that's the Dying with Dignity Bill, and that you've been really involved in that as well. And again, we do chat a lot about bodily autonomy again on the podcast, and, you know, usually it's the more fun kind, you know, this is a little bit different. But the decisions like on what happened to your body at the end of life are also really important, and it is an area that not a lot of people get the level of control that they would like to have over it, and that goes for people with long-term illnesses or short-term illnesses, or a variety of things. So talk to us about the Dying with Dignity Bill and why that's important to you to work on.
Right, so I suppose, you know, because I have a terminal illness, it's something that crosses my mind practically every day. You know, so it's something I've had to think about sooner, I suppose, than most other people. And anyone with a terminal illness who knows their time is coming will tell you the same thing, that you know, you have to start. Some people don't, you know, it's funny, but they're in the minority. Some people kind of are in denial and don't even want to think about funeral. But I'm one of those people. I plan everything in my life, so my funeral is not going to be any different.
We're not surprised, Vicky.
No, I'm a control freak, Caroline. Yeah. So, you know, my funeral and my death are not going to be any different. And no. The way I look, you know, I suppose I took charge of my health and my treatment. You know, I refused the palliative treatment that I was offered because I knew there was something better out there for me. And if I hadn't done that, I would be dead, Caroline. That's the reality. I wouldn't be here today. You know, I'm still here today 2.5 years later because I intervened and got on a treatment that I knew would work better for me. I honestly didn't think I'd get this long out of it. I'll be honest. I thought maybe I'd get an extra, you know, maybe 18 months, you know, but I'm, you know, 2.5 years and I've had a fantastic quality of life. So I'm kind of at the stage now where I wouldn't say I'm more accepting of death, but I certainly got more time than I thought I would. So I'm able to talk about death probably a bit easier than some people because I've gotten my head around it a long time ago. And so the Dying with Dignity Bill was something that I had a huge interest in. I kind of got inkling over the summer from Gino Kenny that he was planning on bringing this bill forward again, because I'd actually been talking about it last year myself and wondering how I could, to Alan Kelly actually in the Labour Party, about trying to kind of resuscitate it, because I knew there had been a bill that John Halligan had brought forward in 2015. And like, there was no appetite last year for it. So I kind of parked it at that stage. And then Gino contacted me and I said, absolutely, because I had spoken about it on a number of occasions in interviews. And I did a piece about it then when Roots died, obviously, you know, I thought it was a good time to bring it up because I knew the bill was coming forward. So I suppose the reason I have an interest in this is because I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't like people to think that I think that euthanasia, you know, generally is acceptable, because I've suffered from depression myself and I was very, you know, for well over 10 years. And there were probably periods in those 10 years where if something like this was available to people with depression, I probably, you know, I can say hands down, I probably would have been very tempted to go for something like this. Yet, you know, I've gotten through the depression through different, you know, things between medication. I was on antidepressants and counseling, acupuncture, running. I tried lots of different things. And I'm no longer depressed, you know, but it took me 10 years to come out of it. So I'm not open to a kind of very broad euthanasia bill. What this bill that I'm backing is for people with terminal illnesses where there's no coming back. Like, I know there's no cure for my disease. I'm going to die. And it's not like I choose to do this today or tomorrow. I'm well. I have a really great quality of life. And I don't want to die, Caroline. That's the reality. I don't want to die. I mean, Jesus, if a cure came tomorrow, I'd be the first person to jump on that wagon, you know. But the thing is, you know, there is no cure at the moment. I know my time is limited, and probably within the next, you know, 18 to 24 months. And I just want to have that comfort of knowing that when my time comes, that I'm not going to be in pain. Because unfortunately, and I have seen it with a number of women, particularly with cervical cancer, any gynae cancers, it's very hard at times for the palliative care team to get on top of the pain because of all the complications and where the tumours are, right? So women suffer quite a lot at the end with this disease, and I don't want that either for me or for my children. My children are 9 and 15. I do not want them to see me suffering like that. It's as simple as that. And I've had families contact me with stories saying the same thing, that they remember when their mother died or their father died, and they still have vivid memories of that sound, the death rattle, they call it, you know, of somebody dying, or of their parent in pain. And the only way to alleviate that at the moment with palliative care is with palliative sedation. And you could be in that limbo land for up to a week or 2 weeks until your body gives in. And my thing is, why should I have to suffer like that? And why should my children and my family have to suffer like that? All I'm asking is that when I am in a hospice at the very end of my days, when I know there's no coming back, you know, with a couple of weeks left to live, let me die peacefully. That's it. That's all I'm asking. Not now, literally when I'm at the end. So, you know, it's a more humane and dignified way for me to die, for myself and for my family. And that's it.
And it really is, like, that dignity is that you have some sense of control and saying, I don't want to have this experience. And it's about kindness, I suppose, as well. You know, you wouldn't put someone through that, and you know, we don't put animals through it, but we leave humans to really suffer for weeks when we know that it's not necessary. And
no coming back, exactly. That's it. No.
And I know from, like, watching my own grandmother die and you know, and seeing the delay and seeing doctors saying, we'll try one more thing, and we were like, we can just let her go, like, it's fine. I don't want her to suffer for hours and hours, when, you know, or days and days and that kind of thing, when it was just like, just, you know, she's had her time, and let her go with a bit more dignity than that. So I think the name is really important. Yeah, dying with dignity, rather than, like you said, euthanasia is a completely different topic. Yeah. You know, and that's like, you're talking about, like you said, like mental health issues and things like that. So, but how do you feel about this success? So we know today, today is Tuesday, that Sinn Féin are now on board, mm-hmm. and you have Labour on board as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have Labour on board as well. Yeah, and I've had a number of independent TDs and senators, and actually a couple of senators from the Fianna Fáil party who have contacted me and who have spoken openly in support of the bill. What we're hoping that will happen at this stage is that for the three bigger parties, so Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, were in government, that they will allow a free vote on this issue, so that they won't make their TDs and senators vote on party lines, because this is an issue of conscience. So that's what we're trying to, not force, but we're trying to, you know, it's the right thing to do. Let their TDs, because some of them will think differently, and they should not be forced to vote if they don't agree with what their party is telling them. You know, so if it's a free vote, I think we will probably see it get to the next stage, which is the pre-legislative stage, where it's scrutinised and there's debate on the issue. And that's the thing, I suppose, that some people think, you know, if this goes through, that's it, you know, there's no debate. No, that's not the case at all. Like, it still has to be debated, and there probably will be amendments made to the bill, maybe more safeguards, you know, things like that, which I welcome. I think that's all good. You know, I think let get to that stage. Let us debate it, you know.
I think some aspects of the media are saying, oh, that's it, we'll vote for it, and then next week we'll be just killing anyone who looks at us sideways, that kind of thing. And obviously it's not going to be as cavalier as that.
No, not at all. And it's because some people are worried about elderly people or, you know, vulnerable people being coerced into this and maybe having a power of attorney sign, you know, sign their death warrant. That is not the case at all. The person who is dying has to actually declare that and consent to this. So you have to be totally compos mentis, and you have to sign it, and it has to be signed off on by two medical practitioners. So there's a lot of safeguards there in place for that, that, you know, there's no power of attorney signing anybody off, you know.
And there's just more dignity in that as well, rather than going off to Switzerland. And a lot of people don't have that option,
and
it's money, yeah, and time. And the fact as well, if you have someone who goes with you, that they can be charged.
Exactly, and I couldn't do that to my family. So, and I want to die at home, Caroline. I want to die at home.
And not have to deal with airports and dying in a strange hotel room.
Absolutely not, no.
Yeah. And, we did have a few measures, you know, similar to this bill before, and they have gotten shot down. But I think the last one was in 2013. The last attempt was at Marie Fleming, who took that.
She took the court case. Yeah.
Yeah. That 2013 Ireland was a very different place. You know, we didn't think marriage equality would pass, and we absolutely definitely did not think the abortion referendum would pass. And they passed by landslides as well, despite the people in government pushing back at every possible opportunity to have those referendums. And then, of course, claiming all the credit for having the referendum in the first place. So do you think that, you know, while that bill might not succeed in 2013, that we are in a very different Ireland, and we have had, you know, a few years now of listening to people like yourself and the stories of Emma passing away and Ruth passing away and all those experiences. Do you have hope for it, you know, it being received a lot differently than it would have been?
I do. I've spoken to a number of people about this, and actually Tom Curran, Mary Fleming's partner, was at the launch of the Dying with Dignity Bill last week with us. And he said that he feels that there's definitely a change. He felt that at the time, you know, there was very, you know, huge support from the public for Mary's case, but not from the politicians. Whereas he feels this time around, there's far more support from politicians, but also that the landscape has changed in Ireland because of the referendum vote and the marriage equality referendum. But also, I think COVID has changed the landscape as well. I think people being at home, and having probably a better quality of life in some instances where they're not commuting, you know, 5 hours a day, and spending more time at home and seeing, you know, family members get COVID, and a lot of people have seen, you know, terrible instances of it. I think it might have changed people's views on, you know, the value of life and how precious it is. And that's the thing, Caroline. This is not about me wanting to die. I do not want to die. I just want to die when my time comes, you know, my own way, on my own terms. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah,
you know what
it's,
I mean?
It's not an assisted suicide or something like that. It's
not suicidal at all. Yeah. I do not want to die. I just want to have that peace of mind where I know when my time comes that I can just go peacefully and I won't be in pain. Because that's all I worry about is, you know, when, particularly with my kids, you know, I do not want them to see that. It's as simple as that. And I don't see why I should have to go through that, you know.
And it just seems like such common sense, and again, dignity and kindness, and, you know, again, that consent of autonomy over, you know, we don't get to choose when we're born, but surely we should get to choose how we die and where we die. You know, the fact that we mightn't necessarily want to die in a hospital bed, like you said, dying at home, there's a lot more comfort, there's a lot more peace. Like, my dad died in his bed, and that just, it really gave me a lot of peace to think he died where he was happy, you know, and, you know, in his comfortable surroundings. It wasn't in a hospital, you know, with random nurses going past, and, you know, and like, because he was very private, and so the fact that, you know, he could have that for himself, I think it definitely gave me peace. And obviously they're not the same situations or anything like that, but just that part of autonomy. And it must feel like a bit of reclaim and autonomy, because a lot of the autonomy has been stripped from you from by this illness and by the medical profession, more so than the illness, because again, if your test results had been read correctly, maybe things might have been different as well. So do you think that the TDs get that, and that they get that it's about autonomy and dignity, and they're not being suckered in by maybe sensationalist media approaches of, we're going to kill off all the elderly people and the people who don't serve any purpose in society?
I think so. I definitely feel that I really was expecting a huge backlash and a lot of kind of trolling once I started backing this. You know, I really did, because I saw what happened with the referendum. I saw some people I know, you know, getting absolutely, you know, terrible comments and nasty, horrible stuff said about them, and, you know, and to them. I really haven't had much of that so far. I've had a few. And actually, most of it has been very respectful. Actually, you know, a lot, you know, some I've actually had posts in the last week or two from, you know, people who are very religious, kind of saying they understand my situation, but you know, maybe they don't agree with my position, and they're praying for me and whatever. And that's lovely. And Caroline, I totally respect people's religious views on this. I really do. I mean, I come from, my grandmother was the parish priest's housekeeper. You know, we had priests and bishops in my grandmother's house throughout my life. So it's not like, you know, I hate people to think, you know, I didn't understand religion. I do. You know, most of my mother's family are quite religious. And I get that. But all I'm asking is, you know, allow me to make the choice for myself. You know, put your religious beliefs aside. That's not for you. That's fine. You don't have to go down this road, but let me do it for myself. And that's it. I'm not imposing, you know, asking people to impose this bill on everybody. This is a choice that people can make for themselves or not, as the case may be, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, not going to be mandatory or forced upon anyone. No. Or, you know, you're going to have papers shoved at you until you sign it. That's not going to be...
No, and I certainly would not support something like that, not at all.
And how can people who are listening get on board with supporting this measure? Like, are you calling for people to contact TDs and explain?
Yes.
Or, yeah?
Yeah, so people have contacted me to say, how can they help? And that's really what, because this is a decision that's going to be made by our TDs at the end of the day in the Dáil. It's going to be debated, so it'll be voted up or down, one or the other, and it's the TDs in those 160 TDs. So I would ask anybody who's listening, if they support this bill and they want to help, you know, please contact your TD and ask them to support it. Tell them you're in favour of it. And, you know, I think public opinion will definitely help to force this one way or the other.
Absolutely. And the timescale then, so we have today, we have Sinn Féin saying that they're on board and it's at the second stage. So where is your time frame going forward with this?
So the next stage is pre-legislative scrutiny, and that'll happen. So what happens now, because it's an opposition bill, it kind of goes into a lottery and then they get picked out. Now, because there's been so much attention on this in the media over the last 2 weeks, chances are this could get picked sooner rather than later. If it was something that there wasn't a huge amount of interest in, they'd probably, you know, leave it for down the line. So we reckon that it could be picked as soon as October, November for the next stage, and then that'll be the kind of period of debate.
Okay.
So before the first term of the Dáil finishes, you know, at Christmas, we'd hope we'd have some idea of where this is going.
Okay, but then it wouldn't be rolled out then if it was to pass and stuff, probably till mid next year. Maybe it's not going to be a rapid process in any
no,
stretch
this is not,
imagination.
This will probably be at least 12 months. Because, you know, it will have to be amended. So, you know, we'll have to get it drawn up. You know, legislative people will have to redraft it. It'll have to be brought forward again. And then obviously, you know, the views of the medical profession, you know, we can't run this bill unless there are going to be medical professionals who are willing to actually help out, you know, and that we don't. That's the bit I see an issue at the moment, that I know I did a head-to-head interview actually on Friday on Galway Bay FM with a consultant in geriatric medicine from Galway. And he was opposed to this and said that there was a position paper that came out from the Royal College of Physicians back in 2007. But I suppose that was 2007, this is 2020.
It's a long time ago now. And
sorry, paper, you know, needs to, you know, you need to rethink that. And I said to him, were patients consulted? And he kind of, you know, I said, they weren't, were they? And he said, no. I said, so how can you tell me that you, and this is the problem in this country, you know, I understand that doctors have reservations about this, but you cannot impose your views as a doctor on patients when it's patients who are the ones who are making this decision.
Absolutely.
So I said, if there's going to be another position paper, I would like to see patients being consulted on this.
That's just such a bare minimum of you know, consulting the people who are at the heart of
absolutely
this conversation.
Patient-centered care, you know, this, and again, it goes back to the heart of the way we do medicine in this country a lot of the time, you know, so.
And specifically female, you know, medicine as well. I think
yeah,
women have had a rough ride, and this, I can never
absolutely
say it. symphysiotomy. There you go. And the trauma around that as well. And again, because that was a woman's thing, it was just swept under the carpet for a while.
There's another one kind of waiting to happen now. I'm sure you've probably read about it, but I think that'll be the next scandal, is the transvaginal meshes, you know?
Yes.
Like that's another huge issue. I've had people contact me about that for support, but, you know, I can only do so much, you know. I can only fight a couple of battles.
No.
And as much as I'd love to, if I was here for a lot longer, that would be another issue I'd definitely get behind.
Absolutely. You know, you need to mind yourself and you know, again, choosing your battles wisely and stuff. And I hope that the Dying with Dignity Bill is a successful battle, because I think it is the clue is in the name, you know, the dignity and the kindness and the compassion aspect of it as well. So, and I really do hope that everyone listening does get in touch with their TDs or talks to their friends and talks to their families and
discussions.
And even to their GP and stuff as well, if that's an option as well, just to kind of say, I'm a human, I'm not a statistic, I'm not a patient, I'm an actual human that would like to have this kindness shown to me when it's my time. So yeah, Vicky, thank you so much for talking to me today. And I'm just like incredibly in awe of the work that you do. And I really appreciate the time taking. And I really genuinely do think, I know you're a very humble person. I know that. But like, you are like that warrior and that champion for change in Ireland, especially on women's issues. So I really do appreciate that. And you are leaving that legacy of, you know, patient empowerment and women empowerment, but also just human empowerment at the end of it all. So thank you so much. I'm not going to fawn all over you, because I could do that all day for like 3 hours, but no one wants to listen to that podcast. But thank you so much.
Today it was a lovely chat.
Thank you. No, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Maybe we couldn't do it in real life, but you know.
I know.
One of these days we might get to meet
up. There you go. We'll have a cocktail or two.
Yes.
World traits. Brilliant. Thanks to all my listeners for tuning in today. And again, as Vicky said, like, please do contact your TD, have those conversations, have the chats with your friends and family, and really try and, you know, have this, I suppose, expansion of compassion in our Irish society as well. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. If you like us, please rate and review on Apple. We're over on Spotify as well if you want to follow. And we're a member of the Tortoise Shack. You can support via patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I will chat to you next week.